To one side were Sonica and her black tears, holding ropes attached to black horses, sturdy steeds that whinnied and stamped in anticipation. While the rebels rode, everyone else would have to walk. In the light, the black tears on each woman's cheeks were stark reminders of how deadly they were. Jai was glad he was on their side, at least so far. The only one missing was Shanti, but soon she emerged too, hauling a wooden barrel behind her. There was a small hole cut in the side, and a steady stream of grey powder was tumbling out, painting a thin line on the ground, disappearing into the mine. From past experience in other mines that used the substance, Jai immediately knew what it was. Fire root. The roots, which were found attached to gnarled old trees growing unexpectedly in the driest parts of the Phoenician desert, could be ground up to make the powder, which was highly flammable. And if there was enough powder in one place at one time... Jai had seen the power firsthand. Personally, he hated the substance, for he'd seen it kill many slave miners if they were unable to get themselves clear of the blast. As far as he knew, the Emperor still used fire root in several of the older mines, in which the gems were harder to get to. But Jai had never used the grey powder in Garadia. "You're going to destroy the mine," he said, approaching Sonica. "No," Sonica said. "There's not enough fire root in all of Fanes. But we are going to make it very difficult for the Emperor to access his precious diamonds. It will take many months to dig out the mine. By then, perhaps, he will be dead." So this was the gift she'd spoken of. Jai didn't know why the thought of the mine coming down made him feel a sliver of sorrow. Garadia was a cage, a prison, a place where people were treated like possessions. And yet it had been his home for 3 years now, a place where he made friends, where he fought for a better life for a people who'd never been given a life at all. "Good," he said, pushing his emotions aside. "What is the plan?" Sonica sighed deeply. "Even I didn't realize how many there were," she said, casting a hand across the people. "I had planned to take them south to a boat. From there we could sail out of the range of the Emperor's slave mark. But there are too many."
"There were rumors that you escaped with others across the southernmost tip of the spear," Jai said.
Sonica looked away, staring at the cliffs and the rising sun.
"Those were only rumors."
Jai tried to catch her eye, but she wouldn't look at him.
"Sonica. Sonica."
Finally, she turned.
"How did you get the others out of Fanes?"
There was something in her eyes. Jai recognized it because he'd seen it in his own eyes before, while staring in the looking glass. Guilt.
"We didn't," she said. "We tried, but the Emperor's men rode us down like dogs. The first group was killed almost immediately, between the cliffs of the Bloody Canyon. The second was more successful. We could see the burning sea ahead of us, glittering in the sun. But the result was the same. I lost many of my warriors and narrowly escaped with my own life. We are all that are left of the Tears."
Jai stared at the ground, considering this new information.
Here he'd thought someone had finally freed some of the slaves, but instead the Black Tears had only gotten more of them killed during the attempt. Were his people destined to die, too? Was it worth it, the risk? Could he still change his mind, usher his people back into the mine, and tell the Emperor the story of an attack by the Black Tears, an attack that was fought off by the slaves themselves, only the mine masters perishing before it was over?
He shook his head.
No, there was no going back. He could see the hope in his people's eyes, in the way they were squinting into the sun, wearing expressions full of amazement, smiles of happiness. They would press on, not south to Sonica's too small boat, but north to the Southron Gates, Jai said.
"That's suicide," Sonica said. "Everything is suicide."
Jai told her and the others about what his father had told him, about the way through the wall. With Shanti's fire root, it just might be possible.
"And you believe him?"
Sonica's eyes bored into him, searching for a lie.
"Yes," Jai said.
"Why?"
"Because my father loved my mother."
Once they were a safe distance away from the mine,
Shanti used a torch to light the grey fire-root powder. Everyone watched the flames travel slowly along the ground, picking up speed when a stiff wind coaxed them from behind. Eventually the flames vanished into the dark tunnel entrance. Jai held his breath, waiting. A few moments passed without event, and he exhaled. He said, "Perhaps there was a break in the trail of powder." Boom! The ground shook, rumbling like an earthquake under their feet. Some of the people staggered, while strong arms shot out to help the children and elderly maintain their balance. A plume of smoke roiled from the entrance as rocks cracked and tumbled from above. The earth went still once more. Silence returned. The mine was blocked by enormous chunks of stone. The people cheered, and Jai found himself cheering along with them, as excited as he'd ever been. It felt like the first step to long-awaited freedom. Everyone was staring toward the mine, so several people let out a high-pitched yip of surprise when a figure stumbled amongst them from behind, collapsing to his knees in front of Jai.
"Master,"
the man said, his voice like coarse sand rubbed across smooth stone.
"What is your command?"
It was Axa, his previous mine master. "And the last surviving one," Jai mused, his life having been saved by his own treachery. His black eyes rolled back in his head and he fell on his face, unconscious, the jewels sewn into his skin sparkling in the sunlight. Sonika's eyes ratcheted between Axa and Jai, her lips a thin line of distrust. "I thought you said no one called you master. Who is this man?" "A new slave," Jai said. Hurriedly, he explained everything, from his meeting with the Emperor to Axa's poor decision to the increase in production quota. "Then this man should die like the others," Sonika said. "He was a bad man, regardless of the slave mark he wears now." There were several murmurs of agreement from the crowd, which had gathered around the Black Tears. A few of them spat and kicked dirt in Axa's direction. He'd been hated and feared by many of the slaves. "It is the people's choice," Jai said, turning away from Sonika to face them. "Would you have me kill this half-dead man? He now bears the slave mark like all of you. Regardless of what he has done in the past, he is another victim of the slave master. He is no threat, but I will do as you wish. He is yours now." A few shouts of, "Kill him!" went up immediately, led by a broad-shouldered man named Joaquin, who'd been beaten several times by Axa while in Garadia. Others, however, murmured, "No, spare him." Pockets of intense discussion ensued, rolling through the crowd. Eventually, each group sent forward a representative. "What shall I do?" Jai asked each. Only one of them voted to kill Axa. It was Joaquin growling the decision. "You have chosen," Jai said. "Now, who will help me bear this burden?" None stepped forward. Joaquin spat in the dirt. "I shall bear him myself for a time," Jai said. He dribbled some water onto Axa's lips, tilting his head back so the liquid would slide down his throat. The man groaned, choking and spitting out some of the water. Jai tried again, and this time more stayed down. Axa dozed, even as Jai hefted him onto his shoulders. As he started to carry him, something hard dug into Jai's shoulders, and he placed the unconscious man back on the ground, feeling about the sackcloth wrapped around his legs. There, hidden in the thick folds of the sackcloth, Jai found a small mirror, its reflective surface dusty and tarnished. His own wobbly reflection stared back at him. Strange, he thought. Normally slaves didn't have many possessions, though they were allowed to accumulate them if they could. Then again, the jewels sewn into Axa's skin contained more wealth than all of the slaves had combined. Still, a mirror? It was a strange thing to have for a slave, especially a new one. "I'll have to ask him about it when he wakes up," Jai thought, tucking the mirror back into the folds of Axa's sackcloth. That's when something occurred to him, something he'd forgotten about in all of the unexpected events of the night and morning. More like someone. Someone whose body wasn't amongst those of the dead mine masters, and who he hadn't seen in the crowd. "The chariot driver," he murmured. "Oh, gods." "What?" Sonica asked. But Jai was already gone, racing back toward the caved-in mine, heading not for the entrance, but for the stables, which were off to the side. He dashed inside, leaping a boulder that had crumbled from the side of the mountain during the explosion, leaving a gaping hole in the thatched roof. The chariot was gone, along with the horse that had drawn it, along with the chariot driver. 10. The Western Kingdom, Night's End. Rhea Loren. The people, her people, were gathered before Rhea by the thousands. She was delighted to see how many of them had cut their faces to match her own. According to her spies in the city, more and more did so each and every day. Legions of the righteous pledging their allegiance to their righteous queen and their god, Wrath, holy be his name. Standing atop the castle walls, she raised her hands to silence them. A hush fell over the crowd, and still she marveled at the power she wielded. The power over sound, over hearts, over minds. The thought of power brought a memory to the forefront of her mind. Grease jollies, no, grey irises, she reminded herself. Sister had power too, provided by the sin mark she bore. What was her name again? Rhea wondered, but just as quickly thought, why do I care? Grease, Grey, whatever his name was, had left her, just as he did the first time in the crypts, and now she had only herself to trust. Then again, she wondered how things would have turned out if he hadn't left, or if he'd taken her with him. She wondered where he was, if he was safe. Secretly, she'd sent a rider to look for him, which constantly made her think, I'm a fool. She realized the people were still waiting for her to speak, their heads raised patiently upwards, some shielding their eyes from the sun. She forced thoughts of Grey away and spoke. In the West, we believe in 7 heavens. The first heaven is for the worst sinners, those who fail to carry out Wrath's will on earth. They will burn for an eternity after they die. She paused, letting them chew on that. Though the idea of the first heaven had likely been hammered into their brains since before they could understand what it meant. She continued, The second heaven is here and now, this world. It is our chance to prove ourselves to Wrath, our chance to display our righteousness. I see many of you who are taking that responsibility, that opportunity, seriously. My hope is that you will all pledge yourselves to Wrath.
"Hear, hear!" someone cried. And another,
"All hail, Queen Loren the Righteous!"
More cheers went up, and for a few moments Rhea allowed herself to bask in their adoration. Once they had quieted again, she said,
"The third heaven is for the apathetic, who die without caring about anyone or anything but themselves. Those sent there will relive the same meaningless life again and again for all of eternity. The fourth heaven isn't much better, except you're given a second chance to follow Wrath and ascend to a higher heaven. The fifth heaven is a cut above, where the righteous go, those who love Wrath, who believe his teachings with all their hearts, but who are too scared to actively carry out his will. It is my belief that most of you will achieve the fifth heaven."
More cheers, which Rhea was glad to hear. It was a calculated risk on her part, telling them they would likely not achieve more than the fifth heaven. She wanted to build them up, but not so much that there was nowhere left to take them.
The sixth heaven is a near miss, for those who did everything in their power to achieve Wrath's will, but who inevitably fell just short because they were too human. Still, it is a position of honour, a place where you can hear Wrath's voice all the time, even if you can't see our God's face.
She paused again, letting the silence build its own momentum.
"And then there is the seventh heaven."
Murmurs raced through the crowd, but they were quickly shushed by the others. Ears craned upward, desperate to hear Rhea's thoughts on the pinnacle of human achievement in the afterlife.
"The seventh heaven is where I long to go, a place where I can look upon Wrath's face and see our God smile. That is why I cut my face, so I wouldn't obsess over my beauty the way the seductresses to the south do."
She saw the fury to her right stiffen, but she remained silent.
Many generations of Lorenz have told you the same thing. My father, King Gil Loren, my mother, Queen Cecilia Loren, and their parents, and their parents' parents, have counseled you to seek to reach the fifth heaven or above. They were not wrong in telling you this. And yet Roth has told me to tell you something else. Something more.
She heard the voice of Roth,
someone cried. Rhea saw numerous heads shaking in disbelief, so she rushed on.
Roth spoke not directly to me, but through God's righteous mouthpiece, one of the three.
Rhea gestured to the fury beside her. The woman, as Rhea had commanded her, said,
"It's true. Roth spoke to Rhea through me."
Astonishment and excitement rumbled through the audience.
"What did God say?"
several people shouted. In that moment, Rhea knew she had them.
"That the people of Night's End are ready. That you are on the verge of something great. That I should counsel you to reach for the seventh heaven, for it stands ready to welcome you with Roth's open arms."
More cheers. Cheers of hope from a people who'd recently lost two kings and were grasping for anything solid to hang on to.
"Our enemies belong in the first heaven. Their sinful ways are an abomination before Roth. The Northerners are corrupt, engaging in behavior more fit for beasts than humans. The Easterners have bred with the Orions, who are known to engage in dark, unnatural magic. And the Southerners? They are no more than barbarians, dressing like heathens, capturing Terran slaves by the thousands, celebrating vile creatures such as dragons and guanic, pisons and vulgers. They are the reason the King's Bane has risen, murdering our monarchs, murdering my father and cousin."
"But what can we do, Your Righteousness?"
an especially loud voice shouted. This individual, Rhea was forced to admit, was a plant, paid to ask that exact question at that exact moment. Rhea even made sure he had a horn to yell into, amplifying his voice. Even from high atop the wall, she could almost hear his pockets jingling with gold coins.
"You earned your reward." "A wise question," she said, "and I have the answer, as spoken by Roth. Are we so blessed as to be able to hide within our walled city, protected from evil, waiting for the day that we'll be delivered to paradise? I say nay. We are only humans living in the second heaven, 5 long strides away from reaching our true reward. Nay, we must be more than the sinners who seek to tear us down. Nay, we must do more. We must cleanse this land from evil, from godlessness, from sinfulness. As humble servants who aspire to reach the seventh heaven, it is our responsibility, nay, our duty, to send our enemies to the fiery heaven they've earned, and rid the world of their influence, carrying Roth's word to every corner of the Four Kingdoms and beyond. Anything less, and we shall deserve our position in the darkness of the first heaven, where we will be hidden from the presence of Roth forever."
Silence fell across her people, who stared at her, rapt.
"We do not wish to inflict violence on our foes," she continued, casting her eyes downward.
Rhea thought of the moment Grey left her alone with the cobbler, which pushed tears to her eyes. A substitute for the real emotion she felt in this moment, anger.
"No, we eschew violence with all of our beings, until it is necessary."
"What would you have us do, Your Highness?"
She scanned her people from side to side, back to front, meeting individual eyes, capturing them in her own sparkling gaze.
"Fight, I say."
And then, louder,
"Fight! And be victorious for our God, for our country, for yourselves and your children's children, and all who come after us."
The crowd's response was a roar, thousands of voices raised as one. Thousands, who Rhea now believed, would fight and die if necessary, for her. She smiled, waved, and turned her back on them. With the Fury standing silently beside her, Rhea sat on her throne, thinking about the first time she entered this very room after her father's death.
How weak I was! How naive! How oblivious!
She wondered if one's life could be defined by a single moment, a single choice, and, if so, what her moment would be. The moment Grey abandoned her in the crypts. Or perhaps the moment she sought revenge on him. Or when she freed him, perhaps. She knew those were all important moments in her life, but not the one. No, her moment was a darker one. The moment the Furies took her beauty from her with the edge of a blade? No again. No, no, no. Her life to this point was defined by the moment she killed her cousin, when she took back what was rightfully hers. The beautiful ring on her finger, the golden crown on her head. The moment she felt the pure power running through her veins. The power to hold a life in one's hand, and either let it go or crush it into dust. The thought made her unbearably sad. It wasn't the moment she would choose, and yet it was all she had. She was stirred from her reverie when her cousin entered. Not Jove, for he was dead, and not Cy, Wheaton, nor Gaia, for Rhea refused to speak to any of her cousins who'd failed to care for her in her time of need. Ennis, the only cousin she'd ever truly liked, perhaps even loved, if she was being completely honest. Though he was 25 years her senior, he'd always paid attention to her, even as a child. And he was the only one who'd come to her after her face had been carved by the Furies. Now he was her advisor. Her only advisor. He stepped forward without speaking, unwilling to meet Rhea's eyes. He was angry, she could see. She'd done the very thing he'd counseled against. Warmongering. If it was up to him, they would carry on the work of fortifying their defences as her father had done, and continue to protect their borders. He didn't understand Rhea's need to attack. He didn't understand that she'd sat back and waited for life to come to her for her entire pathetic existence. And what had it made her? A scarred orphan. No more. Ennis reached the steps and climbed them, but halted when the Fury moved to block his path, her hand resting firmly on the knife at her hip. Ennis sighed, holding out a limp scroll. I have a message from the north. The stream only just arrived, and the parchment hasn't had time to dry. Streaming was the fastest way to send messages across the land, using ink from the strange inkreed plant, which had a tendency to vanish when dipped in water, reappearing in the exact same form in the water where the inkreed was originally harvested from. Then the message could be transferred onto a blank piece of parchment. Hence the soaked page Ennis was now waving around.
It's fine, Rhea said, although she was enjoying seeing this new side of her red-haired protector.
But she didn't fear her cousin. Even if he suspected she'd had something to do with his eldest brother's death, he would never do anything to her. He didn't have it in him. If one of them was a spider and the other was the fly caught in the web, she knew exactly who would play which role. The Fury stepped back on command, like the obedient pup that she was. Her hand, however, remained on the gilded hilt of her knife.
"It's from the north?" Rhea guessed.
"Yes," Ennis said.
"Now Lord Griswold wants to speak," she said. "Interesting that he reaches out after he's amassed troops at Blackstone."
They'd been arriving in droves for the last fortnight, lines of soldiers in gleaming armour shimmering across the waters of the Bay of Bounty. Ships were being built by the north, too. Hundreds now lay moored in the harbour just south of the northern stronghold of Blackstone.
"It's not from Griswold," Ennis said.
She frowned, momentarily confused, a feeling she hated.
"Approach."
Ennis climbed the final two steps and passed her the wet scroll. She scanned the document.
"Year of the Four Kingdoms, circa 532. Queen Rhea Loren, first of your name. First, I am truly sorry for your loss. Your father, King Gil Loren, was a man of vision, who only wanted the best for his people. He was also my uncle, though I never had the opportunity to meet him. I am further saddened by the loss of my mother, Queen Sabria Lorraine Garrick, also your aunt. My uncle, Lord Griswold, who has declared himself King Regent under false pretences, murdered her in cold blood without a true trial. Although I did not witness her execution, my sister promises me that she was courageous and fearless at the end. I can only hope to make her proud as king. Which brings me to my next point. I hereby declare myself the King of the North for as long as I shall live. Already my uncle's forces are gathering at Blackstone to attack the West. I have gathered my own army, which I will use to defend Raiders Pass from the ironclads to the east. Once I am victorious, I will march on Castle Hill and take back what is rightfully mine. I repeat, I am the king, and all negotiations between our kingdoms will be conducted with me. I am not my father, who was a brutal, violent man. Nor am I my uncle, who desires to flood the south with his armies. No, all I wish is to maintain the frozen lands north of the Mournful Mountains, and provide my people with the sense of peace they've been starved of for many years. As a new queen yourself, I assume you want the same for the West. Peace. It's such a strange word these days, but one that is not unachievable. That is what I believe. That is what I hope. I am not requesting your help in retaking Castle Hill. I am simply extending a hand across the battlefield, a hand I hope you will take in a show of good faith. The alliance once forged by my grandfather can still be achieved if we want it to. Your humble northern counterpart, King Archer Garrick, Northern Kingdom. Slowly, carefully, Rhea folded the parchment in half. Strange, she said. We've already received streams that the battle at Raiders Pass is over, with the northern rebels victorious. Someone must have delayed sending this stream, either by mistake or design. And yet this is wonderful news, Your Highness, Ennis said. Perhaps the situation isn't as bleak as we once believed. Rhea held the parchment with both hands, and then ripped it in half. What are you doing? Ennis tried to grab at the paper, but the Fury was quick to block him with her arm. Rhea continued to tear the message apart until it was naught but scraps of soggy confetti in her hands, which she let fall to her feet, grinding them under her heel. Ennis stared at her for a moment, confusion stretching across his face, and then said, "Do you remember our history? The North and the West were born from the same past. It all started with a Garrick, Heinrich, the first Crimean explorer to reach these lands. His son's son, Werner Garrick, fought against the motherland in the First Independence War. Yes, yes, the War of Roses, Rhea said tiredly. As a child, she'd loved hearing the story as told by her history tutor. After the final battle, which took place in Night's End, it was said the streets were so stained with blood they appeared to be covered in a fine layer of rose petals. Hence the war's nickname. It was a good story, full of valour. Blood, yes, but what was a war without bloodshed? And victory and heroes and villains. That was 400 years ago. What does it have to do with the present? Ennis began nodding emphatically, as if he finally believed he had her attention. The Lorrens fought alongside the Garricks and emerged victorious, don't you see? Perhaps you are the one forgetting our history, dear cousin, Rhea said. 100 years later there was the Second Independence War, after the reclusive Garricks had already made their home in the North. Who came to help us then? Not the North, but the East. Should we make peace with them, too, our sworn enemies? Ennis sighed, and Rhea knew she had won a point. Not that she needed one. She was the Queen. Do you know why the Second Independence War was nicknamed the War of Tears? Her cousin stubbornly asked. Rhea frowned, racking her memory. She didn't. Why should a 300-year-old nickname matter to a queen? She said instead. Because you are Rhea the Righteous, Ennis explained. Servant of Wrath and leader of the holy city of Night's End. It was called the War of Tears because after the final battle, in which there were such tremendous casualties on both sides that the dead far outnumbered the living, rain poured from the sky in sheets. The rainfall lasted a fortnight, flooding the land and washing the blood away, cleansing the earth so we could start anew. It was our ancestor, Queen Maloria Loren, who said the rain was Roth's tears falling for our people. She's the one who gave the war its nickname. You were named after her. Rhea frowned. She'd never heard this story. Was he making it up? I am the first of my name, she said.
Ennis placed his hand on her arm, but she shook it off. Ever since the Furies had pressed the knife to her face, she hated being touched. Ennis took it in stride, continuing,
"Exactly. Your parents wanted you to be the first of your name, so they shortened Maloria's name to give you yours. But it doesn't change the fact that they wanted you to be strong like her, which you are, and righteous like her." "I am Rhea the Righteous," she said. "I wear a sign of my devotion to Roth on my face. Would you deny it?"
Rhea could feel the heat flushing her face, the anger needling through her veins. Ennis remained annoyingly calm, his eyes never leaving hers.
"It was Queen Maloria who, after the War of Tears, forged an alliance with the North, the same Northerners who then helped her drive the Easterners back onto their lands when they demanded restitution for the losses incurred during the war. It was Queen Maloria who did everything in her power to make peace in the Four Kingdoms for the first time in its long and bloody history, a peace that lasted for 100 years, long after she'd been embalmed in the crypts."
Rhea scowled at him, hating that he was so reasonable, so logical, even playing to his knowledge that she regularly visited the crypts. What he didn't know was that she went there to meet her paramour, not to mourn the dead. It was there, in the cryptlands, that she and Grey first... She slammed the door shut on the memory.
"I will not use history as an excuse to be weak," she said. "Not when the North has shown time and time again that they cannot be trusted, that they are no better than our enemies to the east and south."
"I don't understand," Ennis said. "Archer Garrick wants peace. Surely you will respond?"
"Yes, of course, dear cousin. I will respond immediately. Please send the following reply. There shall be no peace. Not now. Not ever."
Ennis's jaw dropped open, and he looked like he wanted to speak, but no words came out. His mouth closed, opened again, then closed for good. With a small shake of his head, he left the way he'd come, his head hanging. When he was gone, Rhea said,
"Gather what's left of the Furia. I have instructions. There are preparations to make."
"Preparations for what, my queen?"
the Fury asked.
"For war."
11. The Western Kingdom, The Tangle, Rhone Loren.
"I think we're travelling in circles,"
Gwendolyn Storm said, stopping. Her silver hair fell across the shoulders of her form-fitting armour.
"How can you tell?"
Rhone asked. Her yellow, cat-like eyes flashed with frustration.
"I've seen that tree 3 times in the last week," she said,
pointing to a gnarled oak with enormous roots protruding from the ground at strange angles.
"All the trees look the same," Rhone said. "Big and old."
He knew he was way out of his element. Being from the hot and dusty south, where you could see the distant mountains and sea on a clear day, he was used to vegetation being sparse. Though he'd grown accustomed to the forest from his time spent riding through Ironwood, the Tangle was a whole different beast. The trees, many of which had poisonous spikes sprouting from their trunks, grew together like conjoined twins, wrapped in bushes and brambles and vines, all of which seemed determined to block the path of travellers. Occasionally, Rhone got the eerie feeling that the thorny plants were actually moving to try to stop them, or perhaps steering them in a particular direction. Even the sunlight played tricks on them as its rays fought through the cover of the criss-crossing branches, and they could never tell which way it was moving. At night, the moon and stars were completely hidden, and useless for navigational purposes.
Aye, but I marked this one the last time we saw it.
Gwendolen pointed to a thin cut at the base of the tree.
You're certain it's the same mark? As certain as I can be of anything in this war-forsaken forest.
Roan sighed, and slumped onto a rare spot of vacant ground. After fleeing the Eastern Army's encampment just east of the Snake River, which divided the Eastern and Western kingdoms, they'd swum across the cold, turbulent waters, entering the protection of the ancient forest known as the Tangle. His biggest regret was not saying goodbye to Gareth Ironclad, not being able to explain why they had to leave.
Gods, I don't even know if he's still alive, if I did enough to heal him.
He could still feel the warmth of the prince's lips on his, the one and only time they'd kissed. Could still see the anger and surprise in the prince's eyes. The thought made him sad, which was strange considering the way Gareth, who was now technically the king of the Eastern Empire, and he had first met, almost as if by fate. And then, when Roan had saved Gareth from death, the death everyone had expected from him, considering he was born to be the shield, protecting his brothers from harm, Roan had realized he'd begun to think of Gareth as a friend. That was a week ago. The first few days they took turns sleeping while the other kept watch, but after three uneventful nights passed, they began sleeping back to back. Each night, Roan had relished the warmth of Gwen's body against his. He couldn't deny his attraction to her, nor to the prince, but now wasn't the time to act on it, especially because the Orion was as likely to stab him as she was to kiss him. Now Roan could only hope they were further west than before, perhaps even nearing the forest's western border. But each day that passed left them more concerned that they were decidedly and hopelessly lost.
"I'm so close to home," Roan thought,
"and yet seem further away than ever." For a moment, he wondered whether he would live out the rest of his days in the Tangle, eating bark and sewing together leaves to use as clothing. They could even invent a new language, comprised of bird chirps and gnawing noises.
"Something amusing?" Gwen asked, easing down beside him.
Her arrows rattled in the pouch strapped to her back. Though she'd planned to hunt game in the forest, they hadn't seen so much as an earthworm thus far. She'd brought down several minuscule birds, but they had so little meat on their tiny bones that they almost weren't worth the effort or the potential loss of arrows it took to bag one. Despite his hunger, Roan still couldn't bring himself to eat anything that had once had bones, skin, a heart. Maybe in a day or two he'd feel differently, but he wasn't there yet. They'd run out of bread 2 days earlier. The only water they'd had in the last day was gathered from cup-like leaves that had captured rainfall. Roan hadn't even realized he'd been smiling.
"I was just thinking about the future," he said. "And you found that humorous?"
He pushed his blonde locks away from his eyes. He needed a haircut, desperately.
"As it stands today, aye. Quite humorous. It involves bark salads, leaf clothes, and gnawing. Lots of gnawing. Oh, and a little chirping."
Gwen looked at him like he was mad, a look Roan was beginning to get used to, then pulled out a bundle of straight sticks and well-shaped rocks she was fashioning into additional arrows. She began to carve, the sound, chook, chook, whick, obliterating the silence.
"I'm beginning to think this is a fool's mission," Roan said.
Gwen stopped carving.
"Do you want to go back?"
There was exasperation in her voice, although less than in the past. She didn't hate him quite as much as she used to, perhaps because he'd saved Gareth's life. Even if Roan did want to go back, he didn't know if they could figure out east from west. Anyway, Roan didn't want to go back, that was certain. For the first time in his life he was moving forwards, not sideways or backways, and it felt good. He didn't know what would happen in the future, but he felt comfortable with it. He didn't know whether his tattooia, the three-leaf marking on his chest, known as the life mark, really made him the peacemaker that the mysterious Western Oracle had prophesied would come to do battle with King's Bane. But again, it didn't really matter. All that mattered was that he was doing more good than harm. Step by step, He was moving toward a destiny that was his, and his alone.
"I take your silence for a rejection," Gwen said. "Or have you gone mute?"
Rhone huffed out a laugh. Strangely, despite the fact that the Aurean known as Gwendolyn Storm had shot an arrow at him, punched him numerous times, and stabbed him in the gut, he was actually enjoying her company. They might have different views on the world, but they were connected by their skin marks, somehow. He remembered what she'd told him about the name her father said they used to use for the marks. Fate marks. "Is this my fate?" he wondered.
"I was thinking about how I'm happy for the first time," Rhone said.
Gwen's knife slid clumsily off the edge of the arrow shaft.
"Happy? So you have gone mad, then. Fan-bloody-tastic. I'm serious. We're stuck in the middle of the most horrible forest in all of the Four Kingdoms, and you're happy.
You're a forest dweller. Shouldn't you be at home in the woods?" Gwen laughed without humor, and went back to carving.
"Not in these woods. My home is Ironwood. I feel connected to the trees there. These ones all seem to scowl at me."
Rhone understood what she meant. More than once he swore the trees were giving him dirty looks.
"I've heard legends about the Tangle.
Are they true?"
"What legends?"
"About strange creatures made from shadow and light, sometimes as small as a pinhole, and other times as large as the tallest trees."
"They're not legends," Gwen said, not too happily.
"So they exist?" Rhone glanced about himself, half expecting to be assaulted by one of the trees.
"The stories exaggerate. They always do. But these woods are inhabited by powerful creatures. At least they were. Nymphs and warlocks and sprites. Though that was a long time ago. The forest has grown thick, so nothing is certain anymore."
Rhone didn't like the sound of any of those creatures, though at the same time he felt a strange desire to see one of them.
"And that's why you don't feel comfortable here?"
Gwen nodded.
"Home isn't always one place. But I know it's not this place."
Rhone got that.
"I was never happy in Calypso. Not truly. Sometimes I wondered about why I'd been born."
Gwen threw down her knife, and it stuck in the ground.
"You act as if the entire world conspires against you."
"Doesn't it?" Abandoned by his own parents, tormented by his Southron guardian, who claimed to be trying to keep him safe, afflicted by the plague, attacked by dragons, captured by Gareth Ironclad, and then marched into battle.
"How am I still alive?" Rhone wondered.
If not for his life mark, he knew he wouldn't be. He'd be dead 10 times over. Rhone crinkled his brow. Then he remembered back in Ironwood when Gwen had shown him her treehouse. He remembered the poem carved into the gate. Gwen said nothing, staring into the woods.
"Tell me about your bondmate, the one who wrote the words on your gate back in Ironwood," Rhone said.
Gwen stiffened.
"It doesn't matter." "Those words mattered to you. They matter to you."
He reached over and touched the back of her hand. For a moment, they both stared at their fingers.
"I'm your friend. You can tell me."
And then Gwen pulled away and said,
"I don't talk about this for a reason. Just because we are on the same path now doesn't mean we'll be on the same path forever. It doesn't mean we're friends. So let's just get through it. Agreed?"
Rhone felt a little stung by her words, but he said,
"Agreed."
The Aurean grabbed her knife and went back to shaping her arrows.
Chook, chook, wick.
Suddenly there was another sound. Gwen stopped carving, her head cocked to the side, listening. Rhone opened his mouth to say something like, "What in the name of the Ore Monkeys of Ironwood was that?" But Gwen stopped him with a finger to her lips.
"Don't move," she mouthed.
She mimed putting something in her mouth. Food, Rhone thought she meant, and then chewing it. She went from carver to hunter in an instant, silently regaining her feet, as graceful and lithe as an orcat, but far faster. Impossibly fast. Sometimes the way she moved, slow, purposeful, made Roan think of spilled ink dripping from a tabletop, while other times she was more like a lightning strike, but without the flash of light. The sound came again, a rustle of leaves, the scrape of something picking its way through the undergrowth. Whatever it was, Roan hoped it was large enough to feed Gwen for a few days. With their luck, it was probably a tiny brown mouse. Roan watched as she stole through the forest, her silver hair disappearing behind the old oak she'd marked with her knife a day earlier. A moment passed without a sound, and then another.
"Yah!"
Roan heard her cry, and then there was a shout. It wasn't Gwen's shout, and Roan had never heard an animal make a noise like that before. He leapt to his feet and rushed around the oak, crashing through the brambles with a complete lack of grace, especially compared to the smoothness and silence with which Gwen had just achieved the same path. When he emerged into a small, empty space, he skidded to a stop. "Gwen," he said, "who's that?" Her back was to him, and she was on her knees, pinning someone to the ground. There was something familiar about his boots, which were fine-looking leather and marked with some kind of sigil. Roan froze, his breath catching. It couldn't be, could it? Gwen rolled off of the person, who sat up.
"Ho, peacemaker, what say you?"
Gareth Ironclad said. Roan stuttered and stammered, and then finally settled for, "What are you doing here?"
"A pleasure to see you as well," the prince said.
"No," Roan reminded himself. "Not prince. King. Gareth is the king now." The oddest thing was, they had that in common, being kings, or at least heirs to kingdoms, though only a handful of people knew it. Even bedraggled and travel-worn, he looked unbearably handsome.
"You're here. How is that possible?" Roan asked.
"And you're alive. Thank the gods." Gareth was wearing light linens. Apparently he'd been carrying his armour, which was now cast aside on the ground. "All who grow up in Ironwood learn the great art of tracking," Gareth said. "Though you haven't made it easy, I must admit. Walking in circles for the last 3 days? It was a confounding strategy, but it was quite effective. I only realized this morning that going backward was the best way to go forward, if you get my meaning." Roan didn't. Roan didn't get anything at this point.
"But why are you here?"
Gareth clambered to his feet and strode forward until he was eye to eye with Roan. And then he hugged him, picking him up off his feet before slamming him back down, slapping his back emphatically. Roan's heart skipped a beat. Gareth stepped back and said, "To thank you. You know, for saving my life." He patted his chest over his heart, which was wrapped with a thick dressing pulled tight diagonally from shoulder to hip.
"You followed us for half a fortnight to thank me?"
"Not only. I'm coming with you, of course. Wherever it is you're going. To a night's end, I'm guessing. My brother was adamant in his belief that you're a Lorraine and the rightful heir to the Western Throne, though I'm still sceptical on both of those points. I told him you're a Southron bastard with a rude mouth and a tendency to get himself in trouble."
Gwen cut in. "You're not coming. You're going back immediately. You are the king now. You can't just run off and follow us halfway across the tangle and expect..."
"Halfway? By my estimation, you're naught but a fraction of the way through. Not with all the walking in circles. I'm not going back, and I'm not the king. I relinquished that honour to my brother, Grian."
Roan started to object, but Gareth spoke over him.
"It was never supposed to be me. You understand that, aye? I don't want it."
Roan finally got a few words through.
"This is our chance at peace, don't you see? At least between the east and west. If I can get to Night's End and speak to my sister, we'll have a chance. You and I can change things."
Gareth put a hand on Roan's shoulder, and, once again, his touch felt electric. Roan forced himself to remember the prince's reaction when they'd kissed.
"You're the peacemaker, whatever that means, not me. I am the shield who failed to shield my own brother. My people will shun me.
Roan shook his head, unwilling to believe it. They won't. The Easterners are reasonable, unlike everyone else in this mad land. You can explain what happened. They'll listen.
Gwen said, He's right. And at first Roan thought she was agreeing with him, but then she realized she was talking to him.
You didn't grow up in the East, Roan. Neither the Orions nor the humans will respect a failed shield. He cannot be king.
So you would have him go west, toward his enemies?
Roan felt like shouting at the insanity of it all. He hadn't saved Gareth only to deliver him to the rival kingdom.
No one will know it is me, Gareth said.
I mean, my handsomeness will certainly draw attention, but we can concoct a disguise to make me ugly if we must.
Roan wasn't in the mood for japes. He turned away, a mix of emotions flooding him. Relief that his friend was alive. Anger and frustration that he had chosen this path. A flutter in his chest at being reunited so unexpectedly.
You're a Loren, Gareth said. You can protect me.
Roan shook his head. He wasn't anyone. It wasn't like he could just show up and expect to sit on the throne. It would take time, explanations. Wounds would need to be healed. And anyway, he didn't know if he wanted to be king. More than anything, he wanted to get to the Western Archives and search for information on the fate marks. I want to know who I am.
I don't know, he finally said. Please. I have nowhere else to go.
Roan turned to find that Gareth's mask had fallen away for the second time since he'd known the prince. The first was on the eve of the battle, when Gareth knew he would die.
The night I kissed him.
And now he looked lost and uncertain, a castaway from a ship in a sea of turbulent waters. He wanted to embrace him, to comfort him. Still, the prince had put him through a lot in the short time since they'd met.
Roan waited 5 long seconds, counting them off in his head, before responding.
Fine. You can come with us, he said.
The prince rushed forward and hugged Roan again, and then turned to hug Gwen, but she used the speed provided by her mark to dodge him easily.
Come on, Roan said. We need your help to figure out how to get out of the tangle.
Excellent, Gareth said, his mood quickly changing back to normal. Where are we going again?
12. The Northern Kingdom. Gearhert. Anise Gehrig.
What information could a knight possibly have about my uncle? Anise asked.
Terin said, I love when you act all queenly.
Anise hid her amusement.
Just answer the question.
Sir Metz said he wouldn't tell anyone but the king. We told him there is no king at present, but there is a queen. That's when he requested to see you.
So you sent Sir Dietrich to deliver the message?
Anise almost felt bad for hitting him with the boot. Almost.
Send him in. Not Sir Dietrich. This Sir Metz fellow.
As you wish.
He untangled his body from hers, and she instantly missed his warmth. A flood of memories from their time spent camping in the snow rushed back. It felt like a lifetime ago, not a month. Terin donned his helmet, pulled his mesh face cover back up, and clamped down his eye mask before departing. When he left, Anise attempted to make herself look more queen-like, smoothing her unruly dark hair and blotting the sweat from her face with a dry cloth. Her long blue dress was full of wrinkles from her activities with Terin, but she did her best to press them out with her palms. While she worked, she heard Terin's heavy footsteps descending the stairs, and then the sound of them returning, along with other footsteps. Terin entered first, followed by Sir Dietrich, who, to Anise's delight, was still walking slightly hunched over. The third to enter was a tall fellow with straw-like hair and rosy cheeks. His gait was stiff, almost as if he was marching. He was dressed in pristinely polished silver armour and carrying a helmet under his arm. Presumably, the scabbard at his hip had once held a sword, but either Terin or Dietrich had likely confiscated it before allowing him to enter the tavern.
Netta is making a lot of exceptions to her women-only policy these days, Anise mused. Bringing up the rear was Lady Zelda, her short, pear-shaped stature out of place amongst the tall knights that preceded her. She was holding a bowl and spooning brown liquid and chunks of meat into her mouth. The aroma of the soup instantly made Anise's mouth water. Zelda winked at Anise before taking another bite.
"I am Queen Anise Gerrick, rightful heir to the Northern Throne," Anise said to the newcomer. "My men tell me you have information on the Imposter King's army."
The Imposter King had been Zelda's idea, a way of twisting public opinion in their favour. They paid 60 runners to disseminate the nickname for her uncle across the north, from Darin to Castle Hill to Blackstone, and everywhere in between. They'd also sent 100 streams with the nickname to the most populated towns in the realm. Anise wished she could have seen her uncle's face when he first caught wind of what the people were calling him.
"Yes," Samet said, his voice a monotone.
He stared at Anise, blinking occasionally. Anise frowned, waiting for him to continue. He didn't.
"And?"
she said.
"And what?"
Samet replied. Perhaps this was what Terran had meant when he referred to the knight as unusual.
"And what information do you have?"
"The majority of Lord Griswold's army has been relocated to Blackstone, and will soon attack Knight's End."
"If that is all you know, then you have come a long way for nothing," Anise said. "That information reached us here a week ago via message stream."
"That is not all I know."
Again, Anise waited for him to continue, but he remained silent. She prodded once more.
"What other information do you have?"
"About what?"
Anise almost screamed, her patience stretching to its limits.
"About the Imposter King's army,"
Anise growled.
"I know the exact number of soldiers guarding Castle Hill. 100. Well, now there are only 99, because I escaped."
"Wait. You are a soldier in my uncle's army?"
"Was a soldier. I escaped, like I said."
"Why?"
"Because he's not the king."
"And you thought my brother was?"
"Yes."
"And now that you know he's not, and that the North is ruled by me, a queen, what will you do?"
"Serve you for the rest of my life, or until you die, whichever comes sooner. It is the oath I took as a knight."
Anise almost laughed at his declaration. Luckily, she was able to hold back her amusement because his face was dead serious.
"Then I shall consider it fortunate to have a loyal knight such as you in my service. What else do you know?"
"About what?"
"Frozen hell, fire and brimstone."
She took a deep breath, trying to control her temper.
"About the army at Castle Hill?"
"Lord Griswold's potion, master."
"Dark spell,"
Anise said, crinkling her nose. The wrinkled old potion master had originally been appointed by her grandfather, King Wilhelm Gerrick, the undefeated king. Anise had always found the hunching, bald man creepy, especially because of how he lurked in the shadows when he wasn't in his underground laboratory, concocting elixirs and potions to treat anything from a headache to infertility.
"Yes, dark spell," Samet said, looking annoyed at being interrupted. "At the request of Lord Griswold, Darkspell has formulated a potion for the remaining soldiers at Castle Hill."
This time Anise was ready for a long pause, and quickly cut into it.
"What does this potion do?"
"Creates monsters," Samet said.
It was definitely not the answer Anise was expecting. She opened her mouth, but had no idea how to respond. Thankfully, Sir Dietrich did for her.
"You've seen this?"
Was it just her imagination, or was his voice slightly higher pitched than before?
"I've not only seen it, but experienced it," Samet said.
Something occurred to Anise.
"The soldiers turn into monsters? Is that what you mean?"
"Yes."
"What kind of monsters?"
"It depends on the soldier. All different kinds. They grow fangs, claws. They grow larger, bigger, faster."
She looked him up and down, searching for any evidence of such changes.
"You don't look like a monster."
"The change is temporary.
Anise had no idea whether this man was to be trusted, or whether he might have been sent by her uncle to scare them away from a front-on assault to retake Castle Hill. She glanced at Zelda to see if she was just as sceptical. Her aunt, however, seemed to be ignoring the conversation entirely, throwing back the dregs of her stew with voracious enthusiasm. Sir Dietrich chimed in again.